Okay, here we go. Stand by.
3, 2, 1.
The Thinking Atheist. It's not a person. It's a symbol. An idea.
The population of atheists in this country is going through the roof.
Rejecting faith. Pursuing knowledge. Challenging the sacred.
If I tell the truth, it's because I tell the truth. Not because I put my hand on a book and made a wish.
And working together for a more rational world.
Take the risk of thinking for yourself. Much more happiness, truth, beauty, and wisdom will come to you that way.
Assume nothing. Question everything. And start thinking. This is the Thinking Atheist Podcast, hosted by Seth Andrews.
You can tell people are ready to reconnect as human beings. I mean, safely, responsibly. We saw this in Atlanta at the American Atheist National Convention. More than 500 people got together, vaxxed and boosted and distanced, but we got together, and it was so much fun. And it's nice to see other events on the calendar. Just FYI, I'm going to be at Fort Wayne, Indiana. That's coming up June 25th and 26th for the Better Conference. It's the Conference on Death, Grief, and Belief. Talk about a relevant weekend, because we've all dealt with love and life and loss. That's coming up in Portland, Oregon. That's July 15th through the 17th, Portland, Oregon. NanoCon, going to be in Memphis the end of July. And more on the calendar for the rest of the year. It's all online. You can see it. Links to the ticket pages and details pages, etc. Go to thethinkingatheist.com/events, okay? And I would love a chance to see you there. And, you know, if you're comfortable, shake your hand or maybe even give you a hug. thethinkingatheist.com/events. Okay, let's get underway with the topic at hand. There's video of our conversation. That YouTube link is in the description box of the show. In this crazy, stressful world, I'm always interested in how we sort of recenter ourselves. I mean, especially in the era of the internet. And lo and behold, I have someone who speaks and educates and writes about this very subject. I've got Dr. Ronald Siegel. He is the assistant clinical professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School. He also teaches psychiatry at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. He's author of several books about mindfulness, The Mindfulness Solution, Everyday Practices for Everyday Problems, and Mindfulness and Psychotherapy. Look, it's an expert, and he joins us here. Dr. Siegel, thanks for coming, man.
Thanks for having me.
So I'll just start without getting into the metaphysical, but I mean, do you separate the mind and the body? You know, I know philosophers get into the mind-body dualist thing. Are they the same thing, the mind and the brain?
You know, sometimes described as one is the software and one is the hardware, as a possible way to understand this. But it certainly seems that our experience of consciousness, which is what we call the mind, and what's happening in the brain are closely related. I mean, it doesn't take much. If we're hit over the head, suddenly our experience of consciousness changes dramatically. If we have a beer, our experience of consciousness changes dramatically. So clearly what's going on in the brain changes the experience of mind. And for that matter, all I have to do is say something upsetting to you, and your brain is going to start firing in a pattern which is radically different than before I said that. So clearly what happens in the mind influences the brain. So I think these are two levels of looking at a unitary phenomena. You know, we can look at it in the experience of consciousness or what we can see in a functional MRI scanner, but we're looking at the same organism here.
Okay. Well, I guess we should start with definitions then, right? I mean, if we're going to say the word mindfulness and wrap a whole conversation around it, what's mindfulness? How would you define it?
So mindfulness is actually an attitude toward experience. It's how are we going to work with whatever arises in the mind-body organism at a given moment? And it's an attitude of awareness of what's happening in this moment with a kind of loving acceptance. Much of the time, what we find if we start to watch the mind is that we're clinging desperately to certain things. Oh, I want the pleasurable experiences. I want the things that feel good. And we're fearing or we're running away from or pushing out of awareness anything that hurts or is painful. And what we're doing actually in cultivating mindfulness is learning both to be present and to be accepting of the full range of experience, that which feels good and that which feels not so good. And the irony in that is when we learn how to do it, we actually wind up far more content, far happier and far more satisfied with our lives.
So you're not talking about like a head in the sand, kind of a happy, clappy, let's just embrace the good and ignore the bad kind of a thing. You're saying that we allow it all to come into play, but we keep it in context or in perspective. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but am I close on that one?
No, I think that's fair. And it's, you know, the whole sense of we that's doing it starts to transform. We start to experience consciousness in a way that's closer to what it is, which is this constantly changing, fluid experience. You know, whenever we're in a particular moment, let's say I'm upset about something now, I feel like the world's an upsetting place. If I'm happy right now, I think the world's a great place. And it's actually quite fluid and changing all the time. Like if I were to ask you, what was your worry 3 worries ago? You might have trouble coming up with that, right? And yet at the moment, it was center stage and super important. So one of the things we learn from mindfulness practice is just actually how fluid consciousness is. And as we see that, then we're having less trouble when we're in a particular state. When we're in an unpleasant state, we get it. Wait a minute. It's going to change for a bit. When we're in a pleasant state, we get it. Wait a minute. It's going to change as well. And it makes us much less desperately trying to arrange our experience in a certain way. It allows us to live in the world far more flexibly and with far more presence.
You know, I had this in my prep for later in the conversation, but in your Wondrium series from the Great Courses, you said something that I stuck on for a second in a good way. And you were talking about how I am not necessarily the person I was 1 minute ago. I'm in a perpetual state of evolution or change or what?
Yeah, I think that's fair. If you were to interview my wife, she would tell you that angry Ron is very different from loving Ron, who's very different from anxious Ron, who's very different from hungry Ron, although hungry Ron sometimes looks a lot like angry Ron. But that, you know, we're in these different states of mind and different states of body constantly. And when we're in the state of the moment, it's kind of a different person. It's as though these different parts of us are taking over and defining who we are and certainly coloring our outlook. Look, when I'm depressed, the world looks like a terrible place and I feel like a failure and I have little hope for the future. When I'm, you know, happy or charged, the world seems like a vibrant and fascinating place. And the next moment is a new opportunity for learning or discovery or joy. So yeah, it's very fluid. And the only thing that holds together our sense of self, if you will, are the stories we tell about ourselves, right? Like, oh, I'm Ron, I'm a psychologist, I've written books, I've done podcasts, I'm a father, I'm a husband, I'm reasonably articulate, I'm a terrible artist, et cetera. It's these narratives we tell ourselves about ourselves are what create a kind of illusion of continuity. But if we really see what's happening moment by moment, we realize it's very fluid in here.
Yeah, I'm always talking about myself in terms of chapters, aren't I? A young Seth, when I was a teenage Seth, when I was, you know, an idealist, conservative Fox News Seth, when I left that culture and now I'm a heathen liberal Seth, you know, those types of things. I'm always chaptering up because I guess I'm always in a state of flux or change. I guess we change whether we think we're changing or not. I know there's a culture of people who say that, you know, there's sort of a comfort mechanism in resistance to change. But how would you address that? I mean, are we changing whether we decide to or not, or what?
Well, I think everything is changing always. You know, this is one of the one of the insights that comes from, you know, philosophic traditions going back for millennia. Nothing is constant. The topic we were talking about just a few seconds ago, already we're on to something new. Our listeners might have thought, hey, that's an interesting idea, or no, I don't agree with that. Those thoughts, those feelings, they're gone. They're already gone over the waterfall of experience. And we're now into this moment and this topic. Breakfast, ancient history. The interesting thing is, because we live in our thought stream so much of the time, we're talking to ourselves about ourselves all day long. And, I want that. Or should I have the poached salmon over wilted spinach? That would be very healthy. But the lasagna looks great. We're constantly involved in these inner conversations. And when we're living in this thought stream, in these narratives going through our heads, it seems as though we're talking about things that are very solid and very important. And who I am and what I want are kind of palpable things. But when we start to practice mindfulness more, we start to see, oh gosh, it is really very, very fluid. One moment there's a sensation, the next moment a thought, then a desire, then a fear, then the memory of the email this morning, then the aspiration for what to have for lunch. We start to see, consciousness is actually very fluid, and our whole sense of me is actually very fluid.
There's a common public perception linking mindfulness to Buddhism. Do you get that question a lot, Dr. Siegel? Or you must be a Buddhist if you talk and you're a proponent of mindfulness. You want to get into Buddhism and how we might, is it incorporated into the mental health profession, these Buddhist concepts?
Well, the interesting thing is virtually all of the world's cultures have hit upon some form of mindfulness practice. This is because we spend an awful lot of our psychological suffering comes from our thinking. For example, and Seth, if you wouldn't mind joining me in this, and our listeners can also, think of something that's upsetting to you. Not the worst thing ever. I don't want to be overwhelming, but just something which is at least somewhat upsetting to you. Right here, right now, if it weren't for the thought of the thing, would you be having a problem?
And no, I would not. No.
We realize, no, it's actually the thought of the thing that creates the emotional upset. Even if the thing that's happening is physical discomfort at the moment, it's the thought that it's going to get worse or it's going to last forever that causes me the distress. So this, because this is such a universally accessible observation, virtually all the world's cultures have looked for some kind of method to step out of the thought stream, to try to get perspective on these thoughts that are constantly going through our heads all day, because we realize that it's these constant thoughts that make us miserable. And if I can weave in a little bit of evolutionary history here, the reason they make us miserable is because our minds are not just some neutral computer. They're not simply analyzing the world and figuring out what to do. They have a very strong, what cognitive scientists call, negativity bias. My friend Rick Hansen, who's written a lot about this, says the mind is like Velcro for bad experiences and Teflon for good ones. Bad experiences happen to us, they stick, we remember them, good ones slide right off the pan. And we can see why this happened if we look at evolutionary history. Imagine our ancestor out there in the African savannah, looking at some ambiguous beige shape behind some bushes. They could make one of two types of errors. They might say, oh my God, it's a lion, when it's really just a beige rock. That would be a type one error or false positive. We actually use these typologies, label them this way in modern scientific research. Or they might look at the same beige shape and say, it's probably a beige rock, when it was really a lion. Now, they could make countless type one errors, these false positives, and still live to tell. One type two error, that's the end of your DNA line. Those organisms aren't going to survive. So we can imagine that there might have been happy hominids hanging around, holding hands, telling stories about dynamite sexual encounters and luscious pieces of fruit, but they weren't our ancestors. Why? Because statistically, they died before they got to reproduce. Our ancestors were the ones running around the savannah saying, oh my God, a lion. Uh-oh, not one of those poisonous snakes. Remember that spiny plant, what it did to Uncle Albert? Those were our ancestors. So that's the kind of mind we have. So when we're living in our thought stream, we're very often remembering bad stuff and anticipating bad stuff and feeling anxious or depressed about this. So virtually all the world's cultures have evolved some kind of form of practice to get out of the thought stream. Some of them are what we call mindfulness practices of doing something simple like being with the breath. And indeed, Buddhist traditions have evolved those extensively. Others have developed prayer traditions of various sorts that are kind of repeating the same thing over and over and over in order to step out of the mind stream. Yogic traditions step out of the mind stream. Singing and chanting, which is done in many cultures, step out of the mind, step out of the thought stream in this way. So actually, mindfulness is part of a potential we have that virtually all cultures have developed. It turns out that Buddhist cultures have developed them in greater detail. So the techniques we use in Western psychology are often borrowed from Buddhist traditions, but not because there's something inherently Buddhist about them. It's really talking about what are the causes of human suffering and what are the things we might do to resolve it.
You know, we did a show on Buddhism a while back. It was fascinating. And honestly, at the end of the research for the program, I thought, you know, beyond some of this superstitious stuff, there's a lot I really liked about it. You know, be in the moment and try to get rid of the detritus, you know, carrying all the baggage from place to place. Much of that has to do with the feeling of lack of control, the stuff in the world that might happen, the what ifs, that kind of thing, finding a way to sort of filter those out without being blind to all that's happening. But, you know, Dr. Siegel, here we are in the age of the internet where they're fire hosing insanity of the entire world into our eyes and ears nonstop. That's got to compound the problem of mindfulness, doesn't it? I mean, especially when you've got outrage for clicks, you've got all these people who are essentially monetizing the fact that we are stressed and distressed. What do you do about the internet these days?
Oh, well, totally. Well, the internet is, and media generally is problematic for a few reasons. One of them is that, you know, our brains evolved to be in these bands of 25 to 50, right? That was your total interpersonal world throughout your lifetime. And to live in a small area, you know, even the nomadic tribes never ventured more than about 50 miles from where they were born their whole life. So, and you know, what were the stimuli? It's raining. It's not. The sun came out. It got colder, got warmer. Those are the stimuli. And now we live with a constant bombardment of hearing about mostly pain and horrible things happening to people all over the world. And the people who have devised, you know, social media have discovered that, oh, we can addict people to clicking on things that are going to boost their self-esteem, right? This is a huge part of social media. Is, you know, Zuckerberg's genius was inventing the idea of a like, right? That, oh, when people get a like, when somebody likes what they posted or likes their Instagram picture or something like that, they get this feeling of, oh, other people like me. I'm a worthy human being. I'm desirable. So that feeds right into this other very powerful hardwired desire to basically be a winner vis-a-vis our fields or to be our peers or to be popular in the world. And this is driving everybody quite crazy. Of course, we don't see Instagram. We don't see Instagram or Facebook posts that say, woke up this morning, had the runs again, anxious that my boss is going to give me a crappy review and my girlfriend's going to leave me. No, it's like, here I am doing fantastic things in fantastic places and you're not included. That's what we see. So it gets everybody's juices going constantly, not to mention the horror of war, the horror of terrorism, the horror of misinformation, where, you know, we're exposed to so much. So all of this means we do need to cultivate ways to step out of this world, not step out of it in the sense of deny it or stick our heads in the sand in any way, but to not identify with and believe in all of this kind of messaging. And, you know, what we do with mindfulness practices is we start to, instead of constantly seeking more stimulation in order to find pleasure or find happiness, we actually develop a way to be more sensitized and sensitive as an organism so that very simple things like literally a cup of tea, seeing the sunset, looking at a flower, holding someone's hand, start to become rich, fulfilling, engaging experiences, and we turn our attention more toward that and less toward screen time. The way, you know, screen time works is, oh, we don't have your attention right now. Let's come up with something even more engaging, which usually means either upsetting or titillating, for you to look at. And then we become increasingly addicted to these high levels of stimulation. And what we're doing with mindfulness practices instead is really training the mind to be far more sensitive and to be able to savor and enjoy very simple things. And that is a powerful antidote to the cultural forces that you're talking about.
My wife, Natalie, and I were talking about, you know, there seems to be an action-reaction thing in every culture when some phenomenon happens. And I'm wondering if there will be a little bit of a boomerang away from this sort of flashing white light of constant information, the tweet storms, you know, the online outrage, the clickbaiters. And I wonder, will there be a corrective? Will there be a culture of people who are doing what we're doing now, but in a larger context, in a larger mass, so to speak, where they say, well, I'm going to take specific steps to not be that, to not do that, to recenter, to perhaps be accosted with less information, but more quality information. Do you see a kind of movement possible? And maybe it's already happening?
Well, I think it's happening, but it's really happening in relatively small numbers. You know, there have been many reports that people in Silicon Valley who are developing all of these highly addictive screen activities won't let their kids have a, you know, have a cell phone. That they realize that this stuff is inherently, you know, quite toxic. However, you know, the problem is human nature hasn't evolved a great deal over the last, you know, several million years. You know, we're still these primates walking around with these primate brains that are quite influenceable, right? If you, you know, if you know how they work, if you know basic principles of, okay, how do we get people addicted to stuff? And, you know, how do we get people so that in essence, they'll do the equivalent of pulling the handle on the slot machine. And it is, it's these kind, it's like slot machines, right? When we look at our phones, in the moment that we look at it, several things are accomplished, right? One is whatever our sadness, our anxiety, our concern du jour that might be going on inside, in the moment of distraction, that goes away. It's the same thing that happens when we go to the fridge and, you know, we grab something to eat. It's the same thing that happens when we have a drink. There's a little bit of anesthetizing that goes on when we have access to something interesting on the screen. Multiply that with all of the stuff where everybody's walking around basically feeling inadequate and comparing their inner experience. You know, if we were nation states, it would be as though we're reading our own crime and poverty statistics and looking at other people's travel brochures. You know, it is, you know, the feelings of not good enough, the feelings of somehow haven't accomplished enough. Gosh, I'm not an internet influencer. By the time I'm 22, I haven't started a startup by 30. What's wrong with me? You know, this whole ethos is extremely painful to people. And what's being offered is a little, you know, getting a like somewhere, getting a little something that's going to make us feel better about ourselves. And it's highly addictive. So yes, there's the potential of moving away from it. I'm not going to predict though what's going to happen as a cultural movement, because I don't know, because these are very powerful forces. They're very basic to our minds, and people have discovered how to exploit them and monetize them. And they're going to keep wanting to earn money doing it. And people's nature is such that they're going to keep looking at their devices. So I don't know. I'm hopeful. I'm certainly willing to put forth the message that there are alternatives and teach people how to cultivate those alternatives. And that's actually what I do in my career. But I don't know which forces are going to win out over time.
Well, not to camp out any longer than we have to on the internet, but beyond then the dopamine rush that I get when I'm validated online, I get the likes and the shares and the people who were patting me on the back, and maybe a feeling of superiority whenever I vanquish a declared enemy. I'm sure that's a rush as well. But if I'm understanding you, you're saying that we are self-medicating through distraction.
Oh, absolutely.
So if I'm clicking and I'm sharing and I'm liking and I'm navigating and doom scrolling, I may not be focusing on me in a meaningful way.
Right. And in fact, what I'm doing is I'm avoiding the things that are hard to do. Very few of us are good at sitting still. Very few of us are good. You know, you don't see people just taking a walk and experiencing their body in the clouds and the thoughts and feelings of the day. Everybody's, you know, distracted or something's in their ears. I don't mean everybody, but an awful lot of us are. And you know, it's very interesting. When we go through any day of our life, we have a lot of emotional injuries. You know, how many of the emails that we open are like hurt in some little way, right? Oh, that's a little disappointing. Or, oh, look, this person's doing this and I'm not, you know, certainly that happening on social media all the time. Or, oh, they want me to do something or they didn't like what I did so much. You know, we're not getting nonstop praise and love, right? As we go through our days, where we're experiencing a lot of moments where there are little hurts, little disappointments. Oh, I didn't do such a good job at that. Well, most of the time in the course of our busy day, we kind of push those things out of awareness. We kind of turn our attention away from those feelings. As one of my patients put it very eloquently, you know, when we bury feelings, we bury them alive. They don't just disappear. They remain in the background of our consciousness. If we have open space, they start to come up. How come people, you know, wake up at 3 and 4 in the morning and can't get back to sleep? Pretty commonly, right? It's because all of these little hurts, little things that happen during the day have been pushed out of awareness. And one of the ways we keep them out of awareness is with, you know, the constant screen time, all the things that you were just discussing. So we live in a culture that's hooked on distraction as a self-medication strategy, if not frank medication through alcohol and other drugs and the like. And I'm not coming at this from some puritanical point of view, but just looking at the mechanisms, I think, yeah, this is what's going on. And if we can train ourselves instead to take some time to actually open to our inner experience, all sorts of good things are going to come from that.
Hang on, I've got more with my special guest, Dr. Ronald Siegel, as we talk about enhancing our calm and or properly and in a healthy way managing our stress. And don't we all know what stress is like? More on mindfulness coming up next. Thank you so much for listening, my friends. Very special guest today, the assistant professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School, and he is instructor for the Wondrium course called Science of Mindfulness. And of course, you can check that out and start your free trial. Shameless plug. You can go to wondrium.com/Seth. You got into meditation. Now, I mean, I may be like a lot of it. When I think meditation, you know, I think of the stereotype. I think of the movie, you know, there's somebody wrapped in earth tones and there's incense and, you know, Enya music playing in the background, that kind of thing. But I'm interested from a mental health profession. What do you mean by meditation? What is a healthy, like evidence-based form of meditation?
Okay, well, first, a little bit more of definitions. Meditation is a really broad category. It basically means mind training. So one can do meditation, a form of meditation, for example, to go back to your previous career, that's, you know, prayer, right? Thinking, yeah, of, you know, reflecting on the Gospels is a form of meditation. Then there are things like mindfulness meditation, which are training the mind to step out of the thought stream, be present, and be open to the full range of experience that arises. And there are many other forms of meditation as well. So it's a very broad category. Mostly what we're focusing on at the moment is mindfulness meditation, which is a particular type of meditation, which is about training the mind to have the option of stepping out of the thought stream, being with sensations of the moment. And in particular, because what we're finding is that this is the most transformative aspect, particularly being able to accept the full range of our experience, to really be able to accept and be with pleasure and pain, joy and sorrow, loneliness and connection, the full range of experience, so that we're no longer always constricting, always trying to get rid of the bad stuff and desperately clinging to and seeking the good stuff. It turns out that virtually all forms of what we call psychopathology or psychological distress involve a few different components. They involve being caught in thoughts, right, that are troublesome, that are upsetting to us. To go back to the idea of think of something that upsets you. If it weren't for the thought, would you be okay? Yeah, you would be okay. Well, that's true for anxiety. It's true for depression. It's true for substance use problems. It's true for a very wide range of difficulties. And they all also involve what we call emotional or experiential avoidance, trying to get unpleasant things to stop. I can give you a few examples just to make sense out of that. If I get anxious before public speaking or flying in airplanes, but I do those things anyway, I don't have an anxiety disorder. I'm just a nervous guy. And temperamentally, I am a nervous guy, but I do these things. So it's okay. Anxiety comes up, it passes, it's all right, I can function. But if I start avoiding flying in airplanes because I don't want to feel that anxiety, or avoiding public speaking because I don't want to feel that anxiety, or for that matter, avoiding asking someone out for a date, avoiding applying for the job, you know, we could go on, the list is quite long, avoiding things in order to get rid of the fear or avoid the fear, well, then I have a problem and my life is quite constricted. So we could see in this case, if we could train ourselves to be open to the full range of experience and actually to make friends with anxiety, to be able to feel it and notice it's a set of sensations in the body, and it's actually feels somewhat like excitement, only the topic is different, can transform the whole thing. Depression. If you think of the difference between depression and sadness, right? We've all been depressed to some degree, even if, you know, not as a clinical disorder, and we've all been sad. And yet these are different states if we think about it. You know, sadness is, you know, is kind of poignant, it's alive. Depression's kind of dead and stuck. We could be at a funeral and be really sad and somebody remembers something funny that the deceased did, and we're joyous for a moment remembering that. But if we're depressed, it's all kind of shut down and deadened. And, you know, when Shakespeare wrote 400 years ago, "Parting is such sweet sorrow," we get what he meant today. If he had written "Parting is such sweet depression," we think this guy can't write. You know, we wouldn't still be reading him. So we realize here too, well, depression, that's mostly about shutting down, right? It's about shutting down on feeling, which is difficult, and becoming deadened this way. And certainly, my God, the world's awash with substance use problems. And, you know, why do we use substances? Like, you know, if I've just had a hard day of clinical work and like my body looks something like this with all the tension at the end of the day, and I think, you know, wouldn't it be nice to have a glass of wine right now? Well, I'm trying to change one state that's, you know, unpleasant to a state that's more pleasant. Or if I'm going to a party and there are going to be people there who I don't know, or maybe worse, people there who I do know, and I'm thinking, you know, having a drink would be a nice way to start this. Well, I'm trying to get rid of that social anxiety, aren't I? And of course, doing this, you know, from time to time and in moderation, no problem. But when we do it a lot, we have a problem. So we start to see that across the whole range of common psychological distress situations, this being stuck in thoughts and trying to avoid or get rid of something unpleasant plays a really central role. So that's why these mindfulness practices, which are really about being with what's happening in the moment, opening to them, and really being able to accept the full range of experience, turns out to be curative for a super wide range of difficulties. And there have now been thousands and thousands of studies showing it works. It's actually helpful to people. If you train them in these practices, they have less trouble with depression. They have less trouble with anxiety. They can free themselves from substance use disorders and the like.
It's interesting when you were speaking about how people avoid specific things that may give them anxiety. So in that context, not to restate everything that you're saying, but I want to make sure I'm understanding this sort of, we'll call it your emotionally agoraphobic in that way. You may think that you are just gravitating to security, but this may be like a kind of imprisonment, right? I mean, you're limiting yourself. You're living in fear. Would that be accurate?
Absolutely. You know, there was a There's a story I love. It was about an astronaut who was being interviewed by an actor who was going to play him in a movie about the early space program. And the actor wanted to really understand the astronaut's experience to portray him faithfully. And the actor said, you know, I don't get it. You know, I never would have had the courage to go up in those early rockets. You know, I would have been scared shitless. And the astronaut said, I don't think you understand courage very well. Courage is not about not feeling fear. Courage is about doing what you think you need to do or want to do, even as you're frightened doing it. And most of us mix this up. Most of us imagine that courage means not feeling afraid, or you know, we have this crazy, crazy idea that, you know, real winners have no insecurities, right? That real winners never get discouraged, that, you know, real winners are, you know, and we've had leaders that portray themselves this way, right? As though, you know, only a loser would feel vulnerability, only a loser would have self-doubts, right? And that's actually not how it works. So mindfulness teaches us a kind of courage, which is about the courage of flexibility. And ultimately, it's a much more robust kind of courage. You know, there's a saying, it exists in a lot of cultures. The Japanese version is which is stronger, a reed of bamboo or a mighty oak tree? And the answer is, well, actually, it's the reed of bamboo, because when the monsoon comes, the oak tree starts to have break in half and limbs break off. The reed of bamboo goes over even in a relatively light breeze, but it comes back. And it's got that kind of flexibility. It's that kind of psychological flexibility that we're moving toward, or we're wanting to move toward with mindfulness practice.
And forgive me, Professor. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I'm interested in also some of this must speak to seeing fear in perspective, right? We are evolved to have fear as part of a survival mechanism, right? I mean, we fear falling from height because we don't want to die from a long fall. And that fear is a reasonable one that can often be taken to unreasonable lengths. But I think it's understanding the context and how fear can be exaggerated and amplified, right? Seeing that fear is not necessarily problematic, sometimes it may be protective, correct?
Absolutely. In fact, it's our friend, right? Like think how many times it got us to get back on the curb when the bus was coming. You know, thank God we have fear. If somebody had no fear, they'd be dead much, much sooner. So it's absolutely useful. And luckily, you know, we humans do have some capacity to evaluate, is this actually dangerous, or is this just a threat to my self-image right now? Because it's so interesting. I mean, the other theme that I think is really important to emphasize here, and it's I've actually just done a new book on this topic called The Extraordinary Gift of Being Ordinary, which is that, you know, so often what we're afraid of is something that's going to hurt our sense of self or our self-image. And one of the things that mindfulness practices help us to do, if we take them a step deeper, is they help us to become somewhat less self-preoccupied, somewhat less concerned with what does everybody think about me? How am I doing? You know, am I successful? Am I a good person? You know, these kinds of concerns, which really can fill our days with like, oh, I'm doing a good job right now. You know, I come up with a story, you laugh or something. I think, oh, he's engaged. I'm doing a good job. You know, I am good as a teacher. And then, you know, no pressure, but you look away a little bit and I start thinking, maybe that's not so engaging, right? And yes, I want to do a good job in, you know, sharing useful information to your audience and to you. But there's a whole other level of this, which is like, you know, how's Ron doing, right? Which isn't about how's the interview going, but it's all the self-preoccupation. And that causes us untold misery. And one of the things we actually see with mindfulness practice is we start to see, oh my God, this is all stories that you know, that I tell myself about myself. And I've got these crazy grading systems. Like even, you know, when we're thinking, how am I doing? Like, what's it based on? Is it based on the last 5 minutes? you know, the last 5 months, the last 5 years, or is it like a cumulative grade point average since I was born? You know, how many good things and bad things I've done, how successful or not have I been? And one of the interesting things I found is that people at all levels of society struggle with this stuff, right? People that everybody else thinks are, oh, well, they've got it made. Yeah, we'll have a real conversation with them. And you discover, well, they're going up and down all the time with these sorts of things. So getting a handle on this and beginning to see how we make ourselves so unnecessarily miserable with this is also actually one of the fruits of mindfulness practice, to actually be less concerned with all of my stories about me and to see this organism as kind of unfolding part of a larger universe of other organisms moment by moment.
I guess we're all creatures of both ego and insecurity at the same time, right? The duality of man and woman. I'm interested in, I don't want to give you a question that'll just make a mental health professional, psychologist, psychiatrist, professor, author. I don't want to make you groan out loud with this, but I'm going to ask it, okay? And don't judge me. But we downloaded a mindfulness app for the phone. And I mean, these run the gamut. There's a lot of woo out there, you know, where they're talking about your auras and energies. And this was not that. It was mostly about trying to clear your mind. And I think the vibe was for this length of time, I guess it was 3 minutes, 5 minutes, clear totally everything that's in your mind and just focus on breathing and being. First of all, is that legit? Is it beneficial? Secondly, is it even possible? Because I found myself constantly, I'm like, well, I got to do laundry later and I haven't done the darks. Oh, I've got a meeting tomorrow. I've got to get the darks washed. Well, wait a minute. We're almost out of detergent. I need to go down this. And before I knew it, I'd gone on the hamster wheel again. So yeah. Coming back to the clearing of thoughts, is that legit? Is that part of the goal of mindfulness?
This is not a question I'm going to groan around. This is a central and vital question that you're actually asking. And I'm a little surprised about the instructions on the app, because one of the mythologies about mindfulness practice is that the goal is to have a blank mind, is to somehow get the thoughts to stop. Thinking has been just much too, you know, go back to Lucy, you know, our great, 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 great grandmother, you know, on the African savanna 4.5 million years ago, you know, like, how did she survive? She's only like a meter tall. She wasn't very fast. You know, she had a terrible sense of smell, medium eye. You know, how did she survive out there? Well, her main ace in the hole was this ability to think, right? To start thinking, well, last time I saw something like that, there was a lion's den nearby, so I'm going to avoid it. Or, hey, you know, if I gather up this food now, it's going to help when the weather changes. You know, it was her ability to strategize, which ultimately culminated in us being able to do, you know, video podcasts, right? You know, our ability to think is super, super important for survival. So it's not going away, right? This is absolutely basic to our minds. And what we're actually doing in mindfulness practice is not trying to get thoughts to stop. It's trying to develop what cognitive scientists call metacognitive awareness, a fancy term for noticing that thoughts are just thoughts. They're not necessarily realities. So when you go on to your laundry list or responding to that email or the podcast you're going to do tomorrow, when the mind goes there, you just notice, okay, there it goes again. Let me gently and really lovingly return my attention back to the sensations of the breath, and they'll stay there for about a second, and then they're going to go off. It's going to go off to another one of these thoughts, and then gently come back again. And we keep doing this, not with the fantasy that we're going to get the thoughts to stop, because yes, if you did a silent retreat for a week or more, you might have 5 seconds here, 5 seconds there where they actually stopped, but that's not going to happen for most of us. What will happen eventually, though, when you keep doing that, is you'll start to see the thoughts more as thoughts. You'll start to notice, oh, there's another one of my worry thoughts. Oh, there's another one of those angry thoughts. Oh, there's another one of those inadequacy thoughts. Oh, there's another one of those thinking I'm great thoughts. I mean, all of them. We start to notice them. And the more we can see thoughts as thoughts, the less we believe in each one and the less it has such a grip on us. And we even start to see, you know, to go back to sort of the different mood states that we're in, we even start to see, oh gosh, you know, when I'm kind of down, all these negative thoughts keep coming, right? Hey, when I'm kind of feeling good about myself, all these positive thoughts keep coming. We start to realize they're not terribly reliable, right? They're based on the emotion of the moment. So we gain this perspective on thought that makes us be less gripped by it, but it's not about getting the thing to shut up, because it's in the mind evolved, the brain evolved to secrete thought. That was enormously helpful for survival. So, the biggest obstacle actually to taking up mindfulness practice is having expectations like, I'm supposed to get my mind to go blank, and then you feel like a failure and say, I don't want to do something I'm failing at every day. So you give it up. It's really appreciating that that's not the goal at all. That then allows us to enter into this with a little bit more enthusiasm.
I feel validated that I was not, that I failed, and I'm not broken for failing. How much, physical practice, meaning the processes of measuring your breathing, the deep breath and timing things out and, your environment, maybe lowering the lights, the physical properties around mindfulness. Do you get into any of that? Are there any beneficial things we can be doing physically?
That's going to differ with every individual. And this is great that you bring up these questions, because these are all kind of cultural imagery or stereotype, around this. Remember, mindfulness is just about training the mind, training the brain to have this certain attitude toward experience, how to be with what's happening in the moment, to notice it, to be sensitive to it, and as much as possible, accept whatever's happening here and now.
If I can jump in quickly, Professor, then I'm operating with sort of the stereotype that in order to be mindful, I have to make a calendar appointment and then decide I'm going to go here into this specific space where there are no distractions, and I'm going to set the environment to this temperature, and I'm going to then be mindful. You're talking about mindful as a moment by moment exercise, whether I'm at home or at the bus stop or at, getting chewed out by the boss, from moment to moment, day to day, everywhere we go. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. Okay. And we might, we might differentiate between the kind of formal mindfulness meditation where we might take time out of our day in order to cultivate this ability, and being mindful in situations in our life. Because indeed, there is a role for meditation practice, right? But mindfulness meditation does usually mean, okay, let me pick a reasonably quiet place. Let me get a reasonably alert posture so I don't fall asleep right away. And let me pick an object of awareness, such as the breath, or it could be sounds, or it could be, sensations in the feet. It could be any sensory experience. And let me bring my attention to that sensory experience. And when my mind goes off into some kind of thought stream, gently and lovingly bring it back. So that basic paradigm is part of mindfulness meditation. It doesn't have to have low lights. It doesn't have to have, fancy cushions. It doesn't have to have, any of those accoutrements, although somebody might find that makes it a little bit easier for them to relax, a little bit easier to show up, and a little bit easier to be present, in which case, fine. Mindfulness practice is not about controlling the breath. Here's where these things that come from different traditions can get jumbled in our minds. There are a lot of yoga traditions that are about, learning pranayama, they call it, learning how to control the breath in a certain way in order to try to calm the body. But mindfulness practices, as I'm talking about them, aren't even designed necessarily to calm the body, although that is often a side effect of them. They're really designed to change our experience to whatever's happening in the moment, to really be able to embrace and be present with whatever's happening. And the relaxation exercises, the breath control stuff might help us to do that. But for many other people, that's not a necessary component. And in fact, when I'm teaching it, I'll say, you can't fail at this. If your breath is short and quick, be with a short and quick breath. If it's with a long and deep breath, be with a long and deep breath. We're really just using the breath as a sensory object, a sensation that we can choose to pay attention to, that's going to gently help us to step out of the thought stream over and over and over again. We don't have to control the breath in that way, and we certainly don't have to do anything that feels woo-woo or culturally alien to us, even though for some people who are like really into yoga practice or something, that's a great introduction to mindfulness practice, if you will, because it'll help them to be a little bit more relaxed. And when we are more relaxed, the mind is a little less crazy busy. So it is a little bit easier to focus. But really what we're trying to do is, as you're saying, develop this different attitude toward experience that then carries out throughout our day, whether we're walking the dog, driving to work, or hearing the boss give us a negative performance review.
Yeah, we've had that conversation about prayer, not necessarily in terms of the efficacy of prayers offered up, but the process, the meditative power of prayer. You know, it's calming. You often do it in groups. There's often physical touch involved if you join hands or whatever. And these are meditative practices that actually have a positive physiological effect on the body. I mean, it's understandable why prayer is so attractive in that way, right?
Absolutely. And why cultures have evolved it. And, you know, we might separate out the belief systems associated with prayer, that clearly different cultures have divergent belief systems about this, from the processes that you're talking about, especially when it involves some kind of repetitive phrase where, you know, it's not necessarily even the content of the phrase, which is so critical. It's that we're saying these words instead of planning the next email.
Yeah. You've been very generous with your time. I'm going to link to, of course, the Wondrium course and your books, et cetera, in the description box, because I know we're just taking this as a first step into a much deeper dive. But I want to leave our audience with something proactive. I mean, what's a good starting point if you want to be more mindful, if you want to try to get rid of the detritus and reduce the white noise and try to seize the moments? Where would you start us?
Well, I would start with a little bit of formal mindfulness meditation. And by formal, I don't mean anything fancy. I just mean taking some time out of the day to do the kind of practice that I'm talking about. And it's usually easiest to do that with some guidance. One option, I mean, there's a lot of good options out there. One simple one is I have materials about this that you're welcome to use if you went to drronsiegel.com. And perhaps you could link to that as well. There's sure. A resources section, and it has meditation. Some are linked to the Mindfulness Solution book, which, you know, goes through progressively how to develop and build a mindfulness practice as part of daily ordinary life. But anybody's welcome, with or without the book, to give those a try and, you know, just listen and follow along and see what happens. I mean, I think most people notice that if they start doing some mindfulness practices where they're not burdening themselves with a lot of expectations that their mind's going to go blank or that this is going to suddenly resolve all their problems, they start to notice, oh, this really does shift my experience. And if you take a little bit of a deeper dive, we start to notice that life becomes really very much richer and very much more fulfilling with just a little shift in attitude where we spend a little less time on the screen and a little bit more time noticing the clouds, the trees, and the other human beings in our lives.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds so good. I've found myself just on the hamster wheel, you know, just the overload and the overwhelming feelings, the lack of control, the crazy world we live in. And, you know, life is short. I want to seize the moments, right? I mean, we have to address the negative, but I sure do want to embrace the positive. And I'm looking for tools. I think many of us are looking for those tools to do that. Again, all the links in the description box. Dr. Ronald Siegel, you have been a real joy to talk to. I feel myself more centered as part of this meditative exercise that we have just had today. And I feel a sense of optimism, you know, that we do have some tools to be able to go out and make life a little bit better for ourselves and other people. So thank you so very much.
Thank you for inviting me.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter for a complete archive of podcasts and videos, products like mugs and t-shirts featuring the Thinking Atheist logo, links to atheist pages and resources, and details on upcoming free thought events and conventions. Log on to our website, thethinkingatheist.com.